Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be exploring one of the more intriguing mysteries of human development, and that is the origins of language. Where did language come from? Now, there are some people who have argued that human beings were hardwired for language and that it is something that is uniquely human. However, other people have argued that there are connections between the linguistic skills that we have and the communication abilities of other animals. They say human language is not something that we have, it is something that we do. This morning in this part of the show, we'll talk a little bit about the origins of language and look at some of the ways that scientists have tried to explain this phenomenon. And our guest for the program is Christine Keneally. She is the author of a recently published book that is titled The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. It's published by Viking, and it indeed does take a look at how people have thought about this question over time, and particularly about how recently there are a growing number of scientists and linguists who have proposed that, in fact, evolution was something that evolved. It wasn't just a kind of a linguistic big bang that suddenly it was there, that it evolved over time, and that perhaps there is something of a continuum when you take a look at us and our language and other animals and what they do. Our guest was born in Australia. She received a PhD in linguistics at University of Cambridge. She's written about language, science, and culture for a number of publications, including The New Yorker, The New York Times, Scientific American, and Slate. And she's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. If you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana or on the internet in the U.S., use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. At any point, questions, comments are certainly welcome. We just ask callers to try and be brief in their comments so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody is welcome to call. Dr. Keneally, hello.
Hello.
I'll call you that just one time, just for the sake honoring your PhD.
I think. Thank you.
And I appreciate very much you giving us some of your time.
Oh, no, I appreciate being on the show. Thanks for having me.
I think one of the things I think is just interesting as a way of starting out, as you mentioned, is that it was not all that long ago that linguists would have said there is really no point in thinking about or talking about this question, where did language come from? Because they would say, we have no way of answering the question.
Right, absolutely. And that actually, that situation went on for over 100 years. In 1866, there was a lot of discussion around that time about the evolution of language, and the French Linguistic Society kind of put their foot down and said that that's it, that they actually, there was an official ban on the discussion. They said, we just can't know how it happened, so there's no point talking about it. And to some extent, that was kind of a valid point. At the time, there really wasn't a lot that people could do to investigate the subject. That, of course, has changed completely since then, but that ban mutated into this kind of taboo about the subject. So for a long time in the sort of mid to late part of the 20th century, people were intimidated by the topic, and I think a lot of people felt like talking about it, it kind of made them look foolish. It just didn't have a respectability. But that's changed enormously. There's been a whole series of investigations in many different fields, and people are realizing now if you bring all that stuff together, you can actually start to get a picture of what might have happened.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly difficult. I think as you point out in the book, that we have no fossilized words, so we can't look at that kind of evidence. And I suppose that by looking at fossil humans or a fossil pre-humans, you can make some kind of deductions about their physiology and the kinds of sounds they might have been able to make, and you can also look at their capacity of their brains and make some sort of guesses. But in truth, I suppose some people would say, well, it really does come down to making guesses.
Yeah, there is some deduction involved, but that's an entirely respectable scientific activity. You know, people do that in many different fields, and it's just that this field became so kind of pushed outside of the ivory tower, out of academia, that I think people were afraid that even making some deductions, you know, just wasn't licensed by the evidence. But we are beginning to put stuff together, or researchers are beginning to put stuff together. But you're absolutely right. Some scientists have called this the hardest problem in science today. So just because we're starting to address it, you know, it's by no means an obvious problem. Mm-hmm. But it's still, I think, what a lot of scientists sort of came to in the last 10 to 15 years is this idea that, you know what, it is a worthwhile problem to try to solve, even if we can't work out the answer straight away.
Well, what you do in the book is you present a lot of the research and the thought on this subject, but right. You really concentrate on the contributions of four individuals, and we can talk a little bit, I can give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about them and about their work and what that tells us about where this field is. And there is, you cannot talk about the origins of language without talking about Noam Chomsky. He is the granddaddy of all and still very highly respected figure in this field. I think it's that probably maybe some of the people who are listening to us will know him for his writing and commenting on politics.
Right.
But he is a giant in the field of linguistics for developing the idea that human beings, and I can state it extremely simply, and you can elaborate on it. Basically, he said human beings were hardwired with language ability, not to speak a particular language, but to speak language. And he said that, you know, people came with this deeply embedded set of rules that made it possible for them to do language. And further, he argued that this was something that was distinctly human. Animals don't have it. They can't do it. They're never going to. And it's something that human beings just come with.
Yes, absolutely. And Chomsky is indeed a truly remarkable person and one of the most amazing scholars, I think, of the 20th and 21st century. And, you know, he deserves all the accolades that he's gotten. But he's very interesting because that's the theory that you've just described has been incredibly influential, not just in linguistics, that's where it started out, but it's spread out into many different disciplines. So any sort of scientist or investigator who's looking at some aspect of human behavior or the mind that impacts on language will normally just take Chomsky's ideas as a default. But Chomsky's really interesting because he never actually said that language didn't evolve, but he always felt like it was too difficult a topic, too insubstantial a topic to really address. And that was very much part of this continuation of the kind of the virtual ban on talking about where might have language come from. Chomsky is certainly right in that there clearly are some innate components of language that humans have evolved since we separated from our last common ancestor 6 million years ago. You know, human babies, when they're exposed to language, they start talking. You know, you don't have to teach it to them. And, of course, if you have a dog or even a chimpanzee, people have tried this, you know, and you raise them in the same way as you would a human child, they just don't pick it up in quite the same way. So there really is something that we do have that's very special and that is clearly part of our biology. But coupled with this idea was this notion that if we have it, no other animal has anything remotely like it. No other animal has that language is this kind of very distinct and singular thing that we have, and therefore it is purely human. And that's turning out to be not quite the case. Mm-hmm. And I think what was most significant in this trajectory of sort of Chomsky and language evolution is that he actually published a paper on it with two other just really fantastic and innovative researchers who have looked at language evolution. I think it was 2001 or maybe 2002. So it was a little bit like he came down from the mountaintop, you know, to talk about this subject that he had ignored for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, then let's talk about somebody else here, because you say that there are two individuals that, in a sense, are at the opposite poles right. of this continuum of thought about what is language, who has it, where did it come from, and so forth. And I'm sure that people are familiar, they have heard over the years about experiments that various scientists have done, working with our closest relatives, primates, and doing things like teaching them sign language or using some other kind of device that made it possible for there to be some communication between the humans and the animals. And the one person here that you whose work you profile is a woman named Sue Savage Rumbaugh. Tell us about her.
She's an incredible woman. She, at this time when others weren't really either interested or didn't feel that language evolution was a respectable enough topic, you know, she was kind of out there doing this incredibly practical work with primates, and she was part of, you know, there were a number of researchers at the time doing that, and what Sue's eureka moment was this day. She was trying to teach a female bonobo or bonobo. It's actually, I sort of pronounce it ultimately. There are two different pronunciations. I'm just going to go with bonobo. She was trying to teach this female bonobo called Matata how to use this keyboard, to sort of use symbols on a keyboard and to teach her elements of language. And she wasn't getting very far with it. And then one day she turned to Matata's son, Candy, this young male bonobo. And the very first thing she did with him, he responded, you know, with this kind of fully equipped linguistic response in this keyboard, and she realized that he'd actually been learning, you know, as it were, at Matata's knee all this time, and that just like human children, Kanzi had picked up these language skills unconsciously rather than from being specifically taught. And that sort of changed that field completely. And then with Kanzi, they went on to, you know, develop quite incredible skills with him. He has the ability to communicate up to the level of a three-year-old child. He has hundreds of words. He's able to put together some words with structure and create kind of sentences. He understands spoken English, and there are another few bonobos at the center who do that as well. So, you know, while all these people were saying, you know, we can't know anything about this topic, there was Sue Savage Rumbaugh actually teaching our closest relatives how to communicate to some degree with language.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Christine Keneally. She has a PhD in linguistics from University of Cambridge. She's written about language, science, culture for a number of publications, among them The New Yorker, The New York Times, Scientific American, Slate, and she is the author of a recently published book that is titled The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language, and it's published by Viking. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And, you know, there's a whole another set of questions that you get into in the book that we can talk a little bit about here, because whenever we get into this discussion of language and then perhaps the larger discussion of communication in the animal world, then you really have to ask the question, well, what do you mean by language? Because it's very clear that animals, that various animals do have methods of communication. But then you have to say, well, okay, is that animals have calls, for example, and they make noises that their fellow animals recognize as meaning things like there's a threat, or, you know, who knows what all else. Now, that clearly is communication, but is that language, or is it even anything like language?
Right. It's not. Generally, in that kind of, I think what you're talking about are the alarm calls. Well, people got very excited about 20 years ago when they realized that many monkey species, and it actually has turned out since then, many other kinds of animals make alarm calls. They're specific cries in response to specific predators. So if the monkey sees a leopard, there's one kind of cry. If it sees an eagle, there's another cry. If it sees a snake, there's another cry. So people thought, wow, this is kind of like monkey words. Is this, you know, could this actually be the beginnings of language in these animals? And they realized that these alarm calls appear to be genetically predetermined. If you raise a monkey in isolation, it will still make these kinds of calls. Now, that rules them out as language, because one of the key properties of human language is that the relationship between the words that we speak and the things that we refer to is completely arbitrary. So, for example, the word cat. There's nothing about cat, the word, that would suggest cat the animal, unless, of course, you'd already learned it. So So that was one of the big differences. But the problem was people were sort of looking at the problem with too sort of broad a grain. If you get fine-grained about it, you can see that there are many aspects, not just of animal communication, but of their cognition, that people have just kind of discovered, like that have just recently discovered they have, and they're the kinds of things that we use in our cognition. So, for example, Alex the parrot. Do you know, have you heard about Alex? He was an African grey parrot trained by Irene Pepper Burke at MIT. And Alex learned the words for numbers and words for colors, and he was able to do all these things with words and with concepts that people had no idea birds could do before. And so even though Alex never used these concepts in the wild, what he demonstrated was that he was able to grasp them. And that's the kind of, and these are the kind of concepts that we also use for human language.
Let's talk with somebody who's listening. We have somebody here in Urbana to bring into the conversation on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm having a bit of trouble with the way this conversation is going, and that is the apparent assumption, at least on the moderator's part, that language has something to do with vocal language, or is exclusively. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's a dangerous assumption. Even in human language, we have American Sign Language, which is completely non-vocal.
Right. That's absolutely true. You know, that is a very important distinction to make, and it's been quite a significant point in the debate about the evolution of language. So people spoke for a long time about how language was kind of a thing in your head, and language wasn't necessarily spoken language, and sort of the evidence for this is the fact that, of course, people can learn sign language as well. So that's clearly an important thing to know about language. But, you know, sign language is constructed by humans. Sign language is a very recent phenomenon. And language clearly evolved alongside speech. And I think what stopped the debate for a long time was people sort of said, well, you know, you can't investigate language because you can't say it's the same thing as speech. But what actually happened in evolution and the trajectory that we've passed through is that speech evolved alongside language. So I think investigating both of those things is crucial.
I think we also have to remember that it isn't just the exclusively non-vocal languages, but that even in normal human language, perhaps 80% of communication is nonverbal, expression, gesture, and these even conform to your principle in language that they are not intrinsically meaningful, that they vary with the context.
They do, but there are extremely meaningful things about all of these, what they call extra-linguistic signals. So, for example, gesture. Gesture is clearly a part of human language. It doesn't have to be in the sense that here I am talking to you, we can't see each other, I'm gesturing away, but you don't know that and you don't need to see that. But again, as we've evolved speech and language, we've evolved gesture as well. Mm-hmm. So people used to think that gesture was uniquely human and kind of ruled that out from animals. And just very recently, in the last 10 years, we've discovered that chimpanzees and orangutans, these animals gesture as humans do. They gesture freely, they gesture flexibly, they do a lot of the things that we do with gesture. So there's clearly an evolutionary relationship there. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that these scientists have been investigating.
Well, that was the point I was trying to drive at. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if I wasn't clear.
So you're saying that we should look at that as well? Is that?
I'm saying that in any consideration of language, we have to consider all aspects, including the nonverbal.
And that's right.
Perhaps the nonverbal goes back much farther than the verbal. We know that at some point in fairly recent evolutionary history, the ability to control sound evolved far beyond that of most of the members of the animal kingdom. There are exceptions.
Yes, no, that's absolutely right. Human speech is an incredibly fantastic phenomenon. We can do things with our mouths and with our tongues. The kinds of control that we exercise is really quite unique in the animal world.
It seems to me a little difficult to separate communication from language. That's often, I think, done. We know people accept that animals communicate, but only humans have language. I'm going back beyond the near present, but that's for a long time was a position taken by most people, and it seems to me very difficult to support that. What would be your definition of language?
Well, for the purposes of language evolution, then I'm interested in, and certainly the research that I was reporting on was many different aspects all involved in language. So traditionally when people spoke about language in the Chomskyan sense, they were just talking about syntax and structure.
True.
And this is obviously an extremely significant part of human language. One of the great things about the language evolution research is it's shown that animals do deploy some rudimentary elements of structure in their communication. And we used to say this just didn't happen at all. So there's a kind of a graded relationship there when we used to think there was a complete split. But what I'm also very interested in is extending that definition out and looking at all the other things that are involved in human communication and that were potentially platforms for human language to develop on. So again, that gesture thing is really incredible because other primates do it really in a very similar way to us. And it's just not clear that language, that things like structure and speech could have developed at all if we didn't have that kind of gestural communication to begin with.
Do you think you could define language as the mapping of symbol against context?
You know, I'm not sure that I would narrow it down that much, but language clearly depends on symbols, and that's something that's extremely special about it.
But doesn't it also depend very greatly upon context?
Well, what kind of context do you talk
Well,
about?
Linguistic context, physical context. If you shouted fire and you were out in the middle of the forest, you wouldn't get the reaction that you would if you did this in a theater.
That's absolutely true. It's a very important part of communication. There's been a lot of sort of pulling and pushing about what context means, and I think context itself is so general a word that absolutely context is very important, but there are so many things that you could mean by context, so many sort of very delicate relationships that you might be talking about when you talk about context, that it's probably important to look at all of those as well.
Well, I'm also thinking when I said linguistic context, a sentence like Chomsky's, flying airplanes can be dangerous.
Yeah.
Divorced of context, that sentence has 1,000 meanings, perhaps.
Right.
If you're getting ready to get into an airplane and you say flying airplanes can be dangerous, it's accepted that the flying of an airplane could be dangerous.
Right.
It could also, of course, in a different context, mean that it could fall on your head.
Okay.
So without context, the sentence really doesn't have meaning.
Right, and so, but what you're talking about is communication.
You're
talking about meaning.
Definitely.
Right, okay. And so, but one of the things that Chomsky did, and that, you know, even though a lot of this book is about research that Chomsky, you know, has not, in a sense, blessed, you know, Chomsky showed that you can examine language, this object of language, without having to refer to communication. And that's a really important part of linguistic study. I think where it went wrong over the years is that became the only thing that linguists cared about. You know, these syntactic relationships in a sentence like the one you just said, what do they all mean? How many sort of permutations can you have? And well, again, that's really important, but that's clearly not the whole.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I'm going to jump in here because we're at our midpoint, and I want to invite others and also introduce again the guest, Christine Keneally. She's the author of a recent book. It's titled The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. It's published by Viking, and it does indeed take a look at some of the ideas of various kinds of scholars and scientists and linguists to explain this question, where did language come from? She has a PhD in linguistics at University of Cambridge. She's written about language, science, culture for The New Yorker, for The New York Times, Adams for Scientific American, for Slate, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, I stand corrected. I certainly didn't mean to say, maybe I did, that language was speech and that was that. I think that one of the things that comes across in the book and that you make an effort to talk about is that as people think about this question, you have to recognize the fact that language is, in fact, a package of behaviors.
Right.
It is not one thing, and it doesn't. It's so, for that reason, it seems to defy easy explanation.
Absolutely, and I think that's been the huge innovation, really, that's arisen from all this research. This idea that, you know, language is not a discrete object. It is exactly as you say. It's a package. It's a suite of abilities and predispositions, and that truly we're going to find out a lot more about language and about ourselves if we examine it in that way. And it's when you break down the suite and you start identifying some of the different things that contribute to language that you find these sort of marvelous coincidences of the same things in the animal world as well.
And so, yeah, so then the idea, too, is that if we find other animals doing some of these things,
right,
it's reasonable to think about how, in fact, that there's not, there are connections between what we do and what they do, and that somehow these things all did kind of come together or coalesce over time to lead to this development over time of this thing that we call language.
That's right, absolutely. It's not just about making the point that language isn't necessarily this completely unique human phenomenon, but it's about, you know, tracing these clues back through time about how this trajectory might actually have evolved. So a lot of the stuff that Kanzi does, that these primates do, really tell us that the common ancestor that we had with these 6 billion years ago probably had a lot of those skills then, and that's why we and our cousins, the chimpanzees, still have them today. And so that's a much smarter creature living 6 billion years ago, our great-great-grandparent, than we really knew anything about. And then you take it even further back. So there was this wonderful experiment with a dog called Rico in Germany, and Rico knew a couple of hundred words. He was clearly quite an exceptional dog, but this experiment was set up where I think Rico was told to go into another room and get the X. Whatever the X was, it was a word Rico hadn't heard before. He went into the next room. I think there were six or so objects laid out. He knew what all of them were. He knew what the words for all of them except for one. So Rico inferred that the word he didn't know must correspond to the object he didn't know, and he picked it up and he brought it out again. So, you know, our common relative with dogs was, I think, probably more than 70 million years ago. So that's, you know, that's a creature roaming the Earth 70 million years ago that, you know, quite possibly had that sort of sophisticated mental ability.
It seems that it may be over time that one of the preoccupations of human beings has been to try to figure out what makes them different from all the other animals. You know,
yes.
We're always grabbing for something that says, well, and over time those things get broken down, and then we're still grabbing for something that says, well, yes, but we're different in some respect. And if one says that that, then maybe if we say that all animals, to some extent, have something that we can call language. Then, though, if we say, well, is there yet not something that makes human language different from language as it's demonstrated by other animals? I mean, are we still going to be able to find something that says, well, it is something of a continuum, that there are behaviors that various animals all share, but that there's still going to be something about human language that is going to set it apart from language as it exists in any other animal?
Absolutely, there are. And I think that's the marvelous thing about this research. It actually allows us to find out so much that is the same and it's shared and common, but also, you know, we're left with our dignity to some extent, because it is clear that there are things about language that are different, that even if animals have some, you know, sort of rudimentary beginnings of, they don't have it in the same way we do. So the most important sort of aspect of that is just it's not just the elements of the package, it's the way we put the package together. You know, that's why we have language. We take all these cognitive skills, we take these physical abilities, and we put them together and we create this thing called language. And certainly no other animal, you know, has a talk radio show. No other animal publishes magazines and books. And, you know, the evidence is there. It's as plain as it could be. You know, we do have something that they don't. So we put it all together in a very special way. And then, you know, if you want to get a bit more sort of detailed, you know, there's certainly really important things about human syntax. We can do things with structure, the kinds of sentences that we're saying right now. We're performing all these sort of marvelous feats of connecting words together, and we do it in this very easy, unconscious way. And even if animals do have some aspects of structure, they can't do that, to our knowledge. Let's just qualify that a little bit, just in case. They don't do anything quite like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does seem to be one of the remarkable things about language as it's practiced by humans, and that is that we're actually making it up as we're going along.
Right.
It is a creative activity. And that it's, I suppose that some people, in taking a look at some of the work that's been done with language and other animals, particularly what's been done with primates, there's been this question about, well, are they really, yes, they're learning how to communicate with us using these tools that we have given to them. But that in a sense, it's a kind of imitation. It's not the same sort of spontaneous creative enterprise as it is practiced by human beings.
Right, absolutely. And that's definitely been one of the very controversial aspects of ape language research. And that kind of criticism was leveled at the research in the 70s. And you know, it was really devastating for the field. A lot of the funding dried up because people really began to believe that these were, in a sense, animals performing tricks rather than minds that we were actually communicating with in any way. And you know, as with all of these things, like what the apes are doing has been very much underestimated, and to some extent what the humans are doing has been overestimated. You know, language is this phenomenal thing, and we are very creative when we use it, but, you know, to some extent we rely upon habits of language that, you know, we're certainly not spouting Shakespeare. This is not the equivalent of Shakespeare all the time. But, you know, there have been some marvelous stories about the apes demonstrating the kind of creativity we're talking about. When Sue Savage-Rumbaugh one day was throwing a carrot to Kanzi, and she told Kanzi to put the carrot in the water, and I think there was a sink nearby, and Kanzi threw the carrot outside, and Sue sort of repeated and said, you know, put the carrot in the water, and then Kanzi pointed outside, and it was actually raining. So Kanzi had very creatively interpreted that statement, and certainly the human was the one who was a bit slow on the uptake in that scenario.
I mentioned the fact that earlier on the interview that you're looking closely at the work done by four people, and what kind of light that can shed on this whole question. And we talked a little bit, at least about two of them, about Chomsky and about this woman, Sue Savage-Rumbaugh, who had done some of this work with primate communication with primates. Just I want to have you talk a little bit about these other people and their contributions. And the next one in line, I guess, being Steven Pinker. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
Yeah, well, many people, of course. I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with Steven Pinker because he's published a number of best-selling books about language, and he's quite a famous professor at Harvard. And when he was, I guess, just kind of starting out as a young professor, he got together with a graduate student whose name is Paul Bloom, and who is now a professor at Yale, and they published a paper in 1990 really arguing that point that we were talking about at the beginning, which is that, you know what, language evolution, it's worth looking at. You know, why can't we actually ask the question, how did language evolve? And let's try to answer it rather than just ignore it or push it aside or say it's not worthwhile. Now, other people had said this before, but I think because Steven Pinker was becoming well-known at that time and because he was saying this out of Harvard, a lot of people really paid attention, and a lot of people were very excited to hear that he had actually suggested that it was a worthwhile thing to do. So that paper really kicked off, in a lot of senses, this sort of culture that exists now about that question, and it really licensed people. Now, Pinker hasn't done actually that much on this idea of language evolution itself recently or even since then. But as you no doubt know, I mean, he's very interested in evolutionary psychology and how the mind has evolved. So in a sense, by legitimizing that topic, you know, it's kind of given people permission over the years to look at the evolution of language itself.
Mm-hmm. That I wonder what you think about this, the idea that some people have suggested that indeed you can't separate the development of language from the development of the mind. And by that, I'm getting into dangerous territory. I'm very quickly going to get into where I don't know what I'm talking about.
Let's go straight into dangerous territory.
But I'm not talking about the brain, but I'm talking about the mind in the sense of, you know, the conscious mind. Some people have said, well, you know, that somehow the development of consciousness and the development of language are parallel to the extent that you can't have one without the other, or at least you can't have development of language without the development of consciousness.
Right. Well, here I am speculating wildly in response to that. I think to some extent that's probably true, that you can't have the kinds of human consciousness that we have without the development of language. But I certainly have been interested in the work of people over the years who've looked at consciousness in animals. And you know, at this stage, there's been so little actual research done. It's kind of an item of belief. You know, people in science either think it's probably the case or probably not the case. I think it probably is the case that animals have some degree of consciousness. I wouldn't say that animals are all unconscious. But I think humans do things in their consciousness, with their consciousness, that has got to be facilitated by language, and that allows us to get really complex in our thoughts in ways that I think other animals probably can't.
Yeah, I guess as I understand it, is sort of this notion that to have consciousness, you have to be able to have words so that you can kind of talk about it, but that you without. I'm making a horrible muddle of this. You have to. It's got to be there for you to be able to talk about it. But to be able to talk about it, has to be there. You know, something like that. The idea
I think
those two things apart from one another.
It's exactly right. I think what you're getting at is this idea. I think this probably happens to some extent in individual development as well as over time with evolution. There's a kind of entwining spiral of one supporting the other. You know, and then supporting it back, and then there's this accretion of steps and complexity over the years, and I think that's why it's been so hard to unravel what language is really and where it actually came from, because people have looked at it as this whole, when in fact the way you need to look at it is just really what you said, which is the relationship between it and other parts of the human mind, and you know, and that's where you get this idea of the package of things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it seems to me that if you look at other aspects of human development as the result of evolution, that is that nothing really happened. There really wasn't anything in the way of a big bang. When you think about anything, that why should you then think that somehow the development of language would be different?
Right.
Why not apply just the same sort of general kind of rules that you would to anything else? To
yes.
That, why should that stand apart from other, like the development of, like, why does that, when you ask the question, why do humans walk upright?
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of the same kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. Like, these questions that don't get asked for decades and even hundreds of years, when someone finally comes along and asks them, there's this sense of like, well, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Why would language be different? And I think it was, you know, it was partly this kind of belief beforehand that, you know, humans really were completely unique among all animals, and language was the thing that made us unique, and therefore language was completely unique and very different, and therefore just no one could imagine how it actually came to be. But, you know, quite clearly when you look back through the evolutionary record, you know, nothing happens overnight. And, you know, to some extent, like, so if you look across millions and millions of years, you know, there was some point at which we all started to walk upright, and that spread throughout our species, and that became one of our defining traits. But we didn't just go from sort of crawling on fours, I guess, or walking on fours, to going upright overnight. It happens over time, and it's the same thing with language.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Christine Keneally. She's the author of the book, The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. The book is published by Viking. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe I guess I ought to give you the option or the opportunity here to talk about one more person. This is Philip Lieberman, someone who we were talking earlier about Chomsky. This guy was actually a student of Chomsky's.
Yeah, Phil Lieberman's really interesting. Like all of these people, you're just a completely brilliant human being, but argues for quite different things than some of the others. So Phil was in Chomsky's very first linguistic class, and now, in some senses, Phil's kind of become, well, Lieberman has kind of become the anti-Chomsky. And so all the while that Chomsky and many other researchers were dismissing the idea of language evolution, Lieberman was looking into it. He said he was lying in the bath one night listening to the radio, and he heard someone talking about apes on the radio and just sort of saying that apes can't speak. And he remembers clearly thinking, well, why not? Why can't they speak? So he became very interested very early on in comparing humans to apes and just working out, you know, what do they have and what they don't have and what's different about it. And so he's really one of the first people who's done extremely long-term serious work on the evolution of language. And you know, his ideas are kind of seminal now, really.
All right, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A while back in the New Yorker, there was an article about a language from South America which seemed not to have embedding.
Right.
I can't remember the author, possibly you.
No, it wasn't me. I think his name is John Colapintar.
Yeah. Well, I wondered if, in fact, that article was sound. It seemed to me, I'm a PhD in linguistics, and if there is a language that, say, doesn't have embedding, could that be regarded as one step lower, you might say, in the development of human language and even a sort of stage in its evolution?
Right.
You know what I mean?
I think so, and I see exactly why you would ask that question, because there is this idea that, you know, recursion is the be-all and the end-all, and in exactly the same way David was suggesting before, like, even as we constantly discover that we're, you know, whatever trait we've said is something that only humans have, that actually that's not the case, recursion has now become the ability to embed phrases. So, for example, if I say David thinks that Chris thinks that John said that Chomsky believes this to be the case, you know, that's something that humans do. You know, I think the jury's still out to some extent on that, and I'm not even...
Whether or not that could be regarded as some evolutionary...
Well, no, I think what the jury is out on is whether... So the idea was that these people don't seem to do... do these things in their language with recursion, and then the question is, can they think that way? You know, does language actually control thought? Because we do that with language, are we able to do things with our minds that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do? And I just think the work that's being done on, I believe it's the Paraha, although I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, the work that's been done on that is extremely solid. It has been carried out over many decades. But I think that they've just started to do some experiments where they're actually interacting with these people and asking them to sort of perform certain tasks and sort of measuring the effects of language on thought and behavior in that way. And I think that's what's going to probably answer that question in the end, more actual investigation.
I see. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I guess the reason that why this is an interesting question, I suppose, that over time people have said, well, if we're interested in trying to understand how language developed, if we could somehow establish that there was a hierarchy among languages in terms of their complexity or how they functioned, that might tell us something. But it seems to be the case that languages are equally complex. And that taking that kind of approach actually doesn't work.
Right. Right. That's been sort of the dogma for many years, and I think to some extremely large extent that is clearly true, that all languages are more or less equally complex. Some interesting scholars out there have started to question that. John McWhorter, who I think is actually in a think tank now, and I'm not sure that he's working as a linguist anymore, wrote a book where he talked about the ways that some languages seem to accrete all these complexities in their structure and their syntax that actually do make the languages harder to talk than other languages. I think that kind of work needs investigation. I think that's what will really answer that question. And so far, we just have people kind of arguing the case on either side, but not necessarily doing experimental research.
All right, let's talk with another caller. And this is someone in Urbana also. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I'm a parent, and there's a book that has been fairly popular in our circles, my friend's circles, that I think it's called How to Have the Happiest Toddler on the Block. And the author suggests that we should communicate with our young children more as if they were cavemen than little adults.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, is he correct in that the development of language in small children and toddlers is similar to that as sort of the evolutionary development of language in people overall? And then is there anything in, I mean, if that is true, I'm not sure if it is, but is there anything in your research that might suggest better ways to communicate with toddlers?
Right. Well, I have also read that book. I have young children. It's been a very useful book in my life. I think when the author talks about, when he kind of uses that caveman idea, I think he's just really using it as a metaphor. And I don't think there's any research that he's actually calling on to sort of make that case in any real way. But I think it is a useful metaphor. And then coincidentally enough, there's been some really interesting research done out of Leipzig in Germany recently about comparing human children with chimpanzees and orangutans and comparing their performance in various tasks. So there were tasks of spatial cognition, working out how objects were in space. I think they were also looking at causation. So, for example, if this thing bumps into this thing and then it falls over, you know, do you understand the relationship? And then there was social learning, the ability to kind of connect with other people or to understand what other people's intentions are, even if you don't really have the language for it because, you know, you're a pre-linguistic toddler or you're a toddler without a lot of language. So what the researchers found was that even though toddlers don't have language, they do actually seem to understand minds better than the other apes do. You know, it's all very preliminary. But so I think what they came up with was this idea that, you know, there sort of were shades of, you know, you can call it the caveman idea, that without language, you know, there is this sort of very primitive understanding going on. But actually, humans were in some ways more sophisticated. So, you know, I guess it just depends how long you want to go back, which kind of caveman you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're down to the point here. We have about a minute or so left. We talked earlier about the fact that it was not all that long ago in the field of linguistics that people said, well, there's really no point in discussing this question of the origins of language because we'll never be able to answer this question. And then you said one of the big changes that's happened in the last few years, relatively recently, is that more and more linguists have said, well, wait a minute. This is a fine question to talk about. There's nothing wrong with discussing this question. This is a good question. We should be thinking about it and talking about it. I guess I wonder, though, ultimately, whether the first position, whether there's some merit to the first position in that we can do a lot of talking and theorizing about this, but it, in fact, do the kind of people that you're talked to who are interested in this question, do they actually think that it is possible to arrive at some sort of answer to that question, where does language come from?
I think they think it's possible to arrive at an excellent partial answer, one that will be fascinating and intriguing, but probably one that won't tell us everything that happened in evolutionary time.
Does, other than this just being interesting for the sake of being interesting, is there any sort of practical application for this kind of knowledge, or do we file this under pure science? And yes, indeed, it adds to what we know about human beings and how they developed, but that it's essentially an academic pursuit, and we can't really do anything with that.
No, I think that there are many aspects of the research into the different parts of human language that are really very useful in understanding how language works in the human mind, and you know, and there could be multiple applications of that. So helping children, helping people who have difficulties with language, and then sort of on the sort of technological side of things, actually, you know, people have been trying to work out speech processors and voice synthesizers for a really long time. So this work could all contribute to that to some extent as well. And of course, you know, our understanding of animals and how animals think is another thing that could have many different applications.
Mm-hmm. Just as a way of finishing, I want to ask you about the babies of the Galapagos, just as I think this is a fascinating exercise, because you apparently ask a number of people this question. You said, if we shipwrecked a boatload of babies on the Galapagos Islands, assuming they all had food, water, and shelter they needed to thrive, would they produce language in any form when they grew up?
Right.
If they did, how many would you need for it to take off? What form might it take, and how would that change over time? And you asked that of a number of people, and actually I think you probably got enough an answer for everybody, a slightly different answer for everybody you asked.
That's right. I definitely got a variety of responses. Phil Lieberman, who we mentioned earlier, was the only person who just said, no, just no way language is going to develop. And, you know, his point is not that language is not just simply this innate thing that comes out of us, that you need to be taught language. Other people felt that if you had two people, actually you would begin to have language. And some argued that what you really need is a village worth of babies. So, you know, maybe around 30 babies. It's not enough just to have two people. But if you have 30 individuals interacting, then slowly over time, they'll actually start to put together something that looks like language, maybe two or three generations down the track.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to finish. There is more in this book for people who are interested. Look for The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language, published by Viking, by our guest Christine Keneally. The book's just been nominated for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Science and Technology. And I'm sure you can find it out in the bookstore. And also look for some of her writing. She's published in New Yorker, New York Times, Scientific American, and Slate. And Christine, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, David. It's a pleasure.
Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. Much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, dog trainers Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel will join us. Then later this afternoon, following the closing market report, I'll talk with NPR reporter Eric Weiner about his book, The Geography of Bliss, One Grump's Search for the Happiest Places in the World. Again, that will follow the closing market report. Let's take a look now at commodity prices. In Kansas City, March wheat, $11.43, that down 27. In Chicago, March wheat, $11.00 even, down 14. July, $10.62, down 13. March corn, $5.34, down 23. May, $5.47 and a quarter, down 20. July, $5.59, down 20. December, $5.59 and a quarter, down 20. March beans, $13.70, down 73. May, $14.08 and three quarters, down 50. July, $14.21, down 50. November, $13.11 and a half, down 50. March meal, $3.44.20, down 22.80. March oil, $61.30, down 2.40. At the market in Chicago, April live cattle, $89.95 unchanged. June, $92.27 and a half, up 17 and a half. March feeder cattle, $100.42 and a half, up 62 and a half. April, $103.60, up 52 and a half. And April lean hogs, $57.65, up 25.